the headlines. Turkey's presidential election seems likely to go to its runoff, as no candidate has so far succeeded to win a majority vote and outright victory. Rallies are held across the globe to mark the day of Nakba, the show of solidarity with Palestinians in their struggle against Israeli occupation. And Thailand's opposition claims victory in general elections as the voters reject the military-backed parties that have ruled the country for nearly a decade. Thanks for joining us. The Turkish presidential election is very likely to head to a runoff, as none of the candidates has so far managed the 50% threshold to win outright. After over 99% of the vote counted, the incumbent president Recep Tayyip Erdogan has fallen below the 50%. His main rival Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu is also trailing with nearly 45% of the ballots. Official results will be announced after all ballot boxes are counted. Turks went to the polls on Sunday to elect 600 members of parliament and the next head of state. Some 64 million people were eligible to vote, and a high turnout was reported. Staying with Turkey's presidential election, where the two top contenders are neck and neck as vote counting is still underway, incumbent Recep Tayyip Erdogan and his opposition challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu have, however, expressed their readiness for a runoff. Addressing his supporters in the capital Ankara, Erdogan said he has a clear lead over his main rival, but is ready for a second round if required. He also took aim at Kılıçdaroğlu's campaign, saying that they are trying to fool people with the wrong figures. Both candidates have claimed to be ahead in the race and contested their early lead of the vote count. Meanwhile, Kılıçdaroğlu, speaking alongside leaders of the other parties in his alliance, said that he would win the potential runoff. He also took a jab at Erdogan, saying that he could not achieve the results that he wanted in Sunday's vote.
Turkish citizens have cast their votes to choose a president and parliament members. Polling stations opened at 8 a.m. and closed at 5 p.m., with unprecedented participation, especially from the young generation. According to the Supreme Election Board, 4.9 million are first voters in this election.
I voted for Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, of course, because I am a young person who wants to live in a democratic country. Now our country is not democratic, and because I want to change, I want to reshape my future with Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, of course, because we believe in him, because we saw current president for like almost 20 years.
Some said they voted to change the country, while some others said they voted to revive the legacy of the founder of Turkey.
Ben Cumhuriyet Halk Partisi'yim.
I will vote for CHP, the party that was created by Mustafa Kemal Atatürk. Atatürk said, I left you two legacy. The first is the Turkish Republic and the second is the Republican People Party.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan cast his vote in Istanbul. He said he is happy the election is going smoothly without any incinerators, especially in areas affected by the earthquake. Many believe Erdogan's presidency should not end, arguing Turkey in his era became a developed and modern country.
Cumhurbaşkanı Erdoğan'a vereceğim.
I will give my vote to President Recep Tayyip Erdoğan and AKP. The most important reason is that in the past 21 years, he made Turkey one of the best countries in the world. He built roads, hospitals, manufactured our own defense system. This is the first government to work on manufacturing its own drones. What else do we want?
Many believe today's election will determine the future of Turkey's ruling system, especially with opposition candidate promising to bring back the country's parliamentary system if he became the president. Turkish people have cast their votes. While some here want everything to stay the way it is, others believe it is time to change, and the future of Turkey will be determined once election officials count the votes. Rahşan Saglam, Istanbul.
Israeli forces kill yet another Palestinian in their latest raid on the occupied West Bank. The young man died shortly after regime troopers shot him during a raid on the city of Nablus. The incursion also left another Palestinian injured and triggered clashes with local Palestinians. Nablus has been the epicenter of Israeli violence in recent months, as the regime has carried out repeated raids on refugee camps there. The Israeli violence in the West Bank has claimed the lives of over 100 Palestinians this year. An Egypt-brokered ceasefire between Palestinian resistance groups and Israel has largely held. Palestinians say that they will respect the truce as long as Israel does not breach it. Mona Kandil reports from Ramallah.
Amid contradictory reports on the content of the Egyptian-mediated ceasefire between Palestinian resistance group Islamic Jihad in the besieged Gaza Strip and Israel, Palestinian experts say that the Israeli regime is to abide by the agreement, at least for the time being, but they add that it's unclear how long the latest ceasefire will hold before the regime breaches it. Israel's seriousness will be determined to some extent by the length of the period of calm, they say.
Whether the Israelis are going to commit to this ceasefire, as we know that this is not the first time we have truce or ceasefire. It happened hundreds of times before, and all the time it was Israel who broke this kind of agreement, not just because the Palestinians do anything, but because the Israeli themselves and in this kind of regime, the colonial racist regime, it's used to that.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, during a cabinet meeting on Sunday, told his ministers that the Israeli military took out the entire leadership of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad and by doing so fulfilled the goals of the so-called Shield and Arrow operation in perfect form. He also claimed that Tel Aviv had changed the equation and thwarted the entire top of the jihad movement. Meanwhile, Israel's far-right minister Itamar Ben-Gvir has demanded that targeted killing be carried out against Palestinian resistance leaders in the West Bank as well. He added that the last operation was good and important, but it must be continued.
The most important thing is that the Israeli regime failed to achieve any political goal, failed in restoring deterrence, failed in oppressing the resistance or creating a fraction between the Palestinians themselves or between different factions. Netanyahu has maybe temporarily succeeded in regaining his popularity. However, he will face his problems within days. This round is failure to Israel.
Analysts, meanwhile, say one of the reasons Netanyahu agreed to the ceasefire is Thursday's controversial flag march that is held every year by the Israelis to mark the occupation of East Al-Quds in 1967 Six-Day War. This annual event has prompted fightings in past years as the Israeli regime insisted not to reroute the flag march away from the Muslim quarter of Al-Quds. Palestinians wonder whether the Israeli policies and killings in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds would affect in a way or another the inevitability of the ceasefire, mainly after Ben-Gvir's call to assassinate resistance leaders in the West Bank. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Yemenis have taken to the streets across the country to mark the 75th anniversary of the creation of the Israeli regime known as the Day of Nakba, or catastrophe. Rallies were held in the capital Sana'a, as well as other major cities like Sada'a and Hodeidah, to express solidarity with Palestinians. The demonstrators condemned the expulsion of Palestinians from their homes and the ethnic cleansing by the Israeli regime. They called on the international community to take action to stop Israeli aggression and expansionist policies. Nakba Day was also marked with similar rallies elsewhere across the world. Rallies were held in many cities across the world, including Vienna, Rotterdam, Paris, Berlin, and Toronto. The demonstrators also slammed the failure of the international community to take action against Israeli atrocities. In London, protesters chanted slogans denouncing the UK's role in the creation of the Israeli regime. Nakba Day marks the creation of the Israeli regime in 1948. Zionists who had moved to Palestine from various countries drove over 750,000 Palestinians into exile and wiped off more than 500 towns and villages off the map.
It was a gathering of defiance and hope, a chance for pro-Palestinian organizations and supporters to remind the international community they have not forgotten about justice for Palestine. 75 years on from the catastrophe, there was an urgent message for the world.
Today, and our first message is one of solidarity to the Palestinian people, those across historic Palestine from the river to the sea, those in the diaspora, the Palestinians expelled in 1948 and their descendants, who today are marking what happened in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, the destruction of more than 500 Palestinian villages, but are also marking the Nakba not as a moment rooted in the past, but an ongoing process of colonization, a dispossession and oppression.
Ongoing Israeli aggression and injustices mean the Nakba is not simply a historic moment, but one that demands an immediate response to the current situation.
The Nakba is ongoing, and we have seen the latest threads in that tapestry of the Nakba woven in Gaza, once again suffering the raining of Israeli bombs.
The international community continues to fail the Palestinians, not just for their role in the facilitation of the ethnic cleansing and displacement of the people, but for their continued political blind eye, a blind eye that allows Israel to act with impunity in its subjugation and oppression of Palestinians day in, day out.
Britain's role in not just pushing through the Balfour Agreement, but London's current position as a staunch ally of Tel Aviv makes the demands of the marchers all the more pressing.
What we're asking for as a British public is sanctioning Israel. We're asking for international law to be upheld. If any other country was breaking this many laws this frequently on an international level, sanctions would be placed upon them without doubt. So we're asking for level playing field here, international law to be applied to Israel, sanction Israel now. The Nakba isn't a historical fact. It's a fact that's going on right now.
We want to see an end to UK-Israeli weapons trade going both directions, actually. It's not just a one-way street. We want to see an end to that. And we want to really call our government to account for its complicity, not only in the arms trade and so on, but the continuing repression within Gaza and within the occupied territories. Really, 75 years is way too long. It's 75 years too long, and we want to see the restoration of freedom and liberty to the Palestinian peoples, to their lands and to their state.
As Palestinians continue to resist the occupation with every resource available to them, those demonstrating are keen to show the spirit of solidarity across the globe remains steadfast. Amina Taylor, London.
As the world marks the Nakba Day, Pakistanis take to the streets, raising their voices and banners, standing shoulder to shoulder with Palestinians. This day holds immense significance for people, reminding them of the struggles faced by Palestinians and their right to return to their homeland.
75 years ago, the Nakba, or the catastrophe, struck, resulting in the forced exile of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians from their ancestral homes. Today, Muslims around the world gather to remember the occasion and express support for Palestinians.
The participants condemned the long-standing inaction and passive behavior of the international community towards the suffering of Palestinians.
On this day, in 1948, we witnessed that hundreds and thousands of Palestinian people, they were forcibly expelled from their homeland, Palestine, towards Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, and different countries. So, as your question, why the day of return is important, yes, this is the just-based solution. If the Palestinian people will return to their homeland and they will decide their future, no other country, no other regime, no other government have any rights.
Also, a pictorial exhibition of Palestinian struggle was put on display before Karachi Press Club at the end of the rally.
All over the world, where there's a violation of human rights, all of the countries, America, United Nations, was stand by them. But only in Palestine, they have silence because they support Israel. And the policy behind supporting Israel is that to Palestine, to deny the rights of Palestine. That's why the human rights violation is keep on silencing.
It is a stark reminder that the creation of Israel in 1948 resulted in the expulsion of approximately 750,000 Palestinians from their ancestral homes. Today, over 5 million Palestinian refugees and their descendants remain displaced, and the international community has failed to resolve the issue. Mohammed Turi, Karachi.
Iran has reaffirmed its support for Palestinians, calling for the Israeli regime to be held accountable for its brutality against Palestinians. In a statement to Mark Nakba Day, the Iranian Foreign Ministry said Israel's recent bombardment of the Gaza Strip was a grave violation of basic international law and human rights principles. It said the silence and inaction of the Israeli regime's Western sponsors, pretend to be human rights defenders, has further emboldened Israel to go on with its repression of Palestinians. The statement reiterated Iran's previous proposal that all original inhabitants of Palestinian lands must return to their homes and a referendum should be held there to determine the future of the people. Thai opposition claims victory after an election result that left Move Forward Party the biggest in parliament. A massive surge for MFP in Sunday's ballot left it on course to be the biggest party, followed by another opposition party, namely the Pheu Thai Party, or movement. The opposition parties were contesting against former coup leader and Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-cha. The United Thai Nation Party, led by the ex-army chief who seized power in a 2014 coup, stood a distant third. Now the MFP leader says he is ready for taking the role of Prime Minister.
The people of Thailand have already spoken their wish, and I am ready to be the Prime Minister for all, whether you agree with me or you disagree with me. I have congratulated Khun Pae Thong Thanh from Pheu Thai for her hard-fought campaign and have invited her to join the coalition. And that includes five more parties in the previous opposition.
Pheu also repeated a promise to reform a law that imposes harsh prison terms for insulting the monarchy. Around 52 million people were eligible to vote. The new premier will be chosen jointly by the 500 elected MPs and 250 Senate members appointed by the junta. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has once again warned of catastrophic consequences for the nation's economy if the country defaults on its debt payments. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has forecast that the country could default on its debts by June 15 if lawmakers fail to agree to raise current limits on government spending. For weeks, U.S. policymakers, bankers, and the White House have warned that the U.S. is on the brink of a default, which could plunge the country into a recession and see millions of jobs lost. Democratic leaders are calling for the limit to be raised, but Republicans want spending cuts and other conditions to be agreed first. U.S. national debt currently stands at around $31.5 trillion. Default would also trigger a global economic downturn. France says it will send dozens of armored vehicles and light tanks to Ukraine in the coming weeks to help the country in its war with Russia. That was announced in a joint statement after the French President Emmanuel Macron held talks with his Ukrainian counterpart, Volodymyr Zelensky, in Paris. France also indicated that it was concentrating its efforts on supporting Kiev's air defense capabilities against Russian strikes. Zelensky's visit to Paris was part of his weekend tour of several key European allies to drum up military and financial support ahead of an expected counteroffensive against Russian forces. The U.S. and its Western allies have already supplied billions of dollars worth of military aid to Kiev. Russia has time and again warned that Western military aid to Ukraine will only complicate the situation. And with that, we come to an end for this additional world news. Bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio. Thank you.
in the limelight.
At least 34 Palestinians, including 6 children, have been killed in the recent Israeli regime bombing campaign. This is while Biden administration quietly backs the Zionist regime's deadly assaults on Gaza. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. Truthout noted, it should come as no surprise that the United States has fully backed the Zionist regime in its recent assault against Gaza. In the hours before the Zionist regime began raining down more bombs on the besieged territory, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken spoke with the Zionist regime Foreign Minister Eli Cohen over the phone. While the readout of their call did not mention what war, at the time, escalating tensions with the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, it is certain that the matter was discussed and that the Zionist regime's intention to bring still more devastation to Gaza did not catch the United States by surprise. Yet, as always, the U.S. response, or lack thereof, is important and needs to be examined. Under President Joe Biden's administration, the U.S. silent support of virtually all Israeli regime actions against the Palestinians has remained as absolute as it was during the administration of Donald Trump, despite growing unease with the Zionist regime's behavior among the majority of Americans. In the occupied territories, the assault on Gaza and the commitment rocket fire coming into southern occupied territories have served to provide a temporary scab over the fracture in the Zionist regime society caused by the current government's efforts to destroy the democracy. In the United States, it has allowed the people to more easily ignore this growing authoritarianism mere days ahead of 75th anniversary of the Zionist regime's Nakba. The argument that Israel has the right to defend itself has quickly made the rounds, and with it, the narrative that the rockets launched from Gaza were random, unprovoked, and expressions of an irrational Palestinian desire to kill Israelis. The reality is, of course, very different, and its burial is a key strategic component that must be countered. On May 2nd, PIJ spokesperson and activist Khazar Adnan died in an Israeli regime prison after an 87-day hunger strike. Despite his outspoken advocacy for resistance and activism in PIJ, the fabricated regime of Israel never charged Adnan with any act of violence. He died after the Zionist regime refused to transfer him to the hospital, despite warnings that his condition was life-threatening. Many viewed Adnan's death as killing by deliberate inaction, and rockets were launched from Gaza while protesters confronted the Zionist regime security forces in the West Bank. A ceasefire and the quiet day-to-day occupation and Israeli regime dominance briefly resumed. But some in the occupied territories were dissatisfied that the Israeli regime response was not harsher. Itamar Ben-Gvir, the radical Kahanist Minister of Internal Security, boycotted government activity and even raised the specter of quitting the government if the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu did not move to do more damage to Gaza. We'll be right back. Netanyahu denied this was the reason for breaking the fragile ceasefire that was reached after May 2nd, but in any case, the Zionist regime launched its latest operation and, in the first wave, killed not only three PIJ leaders but 10 others, including the entire family of one of those targeted. In all, at least 34 Palestinians, including 6 children, have been martyred. In this case, it is clearer than usual that this was in no way the Zionist regime defending itself. The fabricated regime of Israel provoked the entire episode by killing Khadr Adnan through willful neglect. Then, when a brief escalation was stopped, the Zionist regime made the decision, whether due to Ben-Gvir's pressure or not, to attack not only PIJ in a blatantly illegal extrajudicial killing, but to do so by bombing their residences, when their spouses and children would be sleeping and at their most defenseless. Despite reports that the Biden administration was urging the Zionist regime to find a way to resume the ceasefire, the Israeli regime continued its airstrikes against Gaza. PIJ rockets continued to fly from Gaza in response, and while the overwhelming majority of these either fell harmlessly or were intercepted, one did strike a residential building in a Tel Aviv suburb, causing a fatality which will mean ongoing escalation. Netanyahu stated that the attacks on Gaza would continue as long as necessary, a clear indication that any pressure from Washington was not serious. Indeed, senior Biden administration officials, including National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and Ambassador to the Occupied Territories Tom Knights, were all unified and unequivocal in their full support of the fabricated regime of Israel, barely paying lip service to hope for a ceasefire.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to another edition of Spotlight. Foreign ministers of the Arab League member states have agreed to reinstate Syria's membership after its suspension more than 10 years ago. The turn of events comes amid a flurry of regional normalization of ties with Damascus in recent weeks. In this edition of Spotlight, we will discuss the significance of this development ahead of the Arab League summit, which is set to be held in Saudi Arabia on May 19th. What this means for the region and for the world. To do so, we're joined by Laith Maarouf, activist and political commentator, who is joining us live from Beirut. We also have with us Peter Ford, a former British ambassador to Syria, who is joining us from Manchester. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen. Let's begin with Mr. Maarouf from Beirut. Mr. Maarouf, Syria's Arab League membership was revoked in 2011. What was the reason behind this in the first place?
Clearly, the reason behind it was the pressure of the United States on its local vessels to push out Syria was defending itself against an invasion by Wahhabi death squads funded by the local vessels of the United States and backed by the CIA. Today, what we see is a return of the Arab League to Syria. It is not a return of Syria to the Arab League, it's a return of the Arab League to Syria and a return of all those countries that at one moment over those 11 years harmed Syria, coming back for ending those hostilities and in almost begging for goodwill. And so now we see the importance of geography in the sense that Ibn Khaldun will tell us the fate that is written for Damascus because of its geographic location. The region cannot have a balance without Damascus being at the center of it. And of course, we see the Arab League coming back to Damascus. We see Turkey attempting to end its hostilities with Syria, and a blossoming of the axis of resistance led with Iran, the president arriving in the last 2 days to Damascus also. So that's the importance of geography and the fate of the country of Syria.
Exactly. Those are very important issues you just mentioned. And 2023 seems to be a year of turning a new page, if you will, for regional developments as far as Syria is concerned. Let's bring in Mr. Ford. Mr. Ford, can you shed more light on the geostrategic location of Syria, and why didn't these countries consider this in the first place when they actually decided that Syria should not be part of the Arab League? Didn't they know how important Syria was? What did they have in mind back then?
Well, I think they had been deceived by the United States, which was telling them that, according to U.S. intelligence, the Assad government was bound to fall. It was just a matter of time. And the Arab states, or many of them, thought that they would join the U.S. push to overthrow the government of Syria. Some of them, let's not forget, also were supporting very actively some of the Gulf countries, particularly were supporting the armed opposition groups. So they wanted to isolate Syria anyway. But a big factor was the U.S. pressure on Arab states.
So, Mr. Ford, do you believe that Bashar Assad's, let's say, the way he has solidified his position in Syria is the reason why these Arab countries are turning back towards Syria?
That's a big part of the reason, but there are other factors in play. It's very interesting now we're seeing the Arab world, led particularly by Saudi Arabia, in a new partnership with Cairo, more defiant towards America, no longer prepared to be dictated to by the United States. Believe me, this development is a bitter blow for the United States. They tried to pressure countries like Jordan, weaker countries, not to join in the consensus, but this failed. This year, partly as a result of the geopolitical situation with Ukraine, partly because of general U.S. Weakness and failure from Afghanistan through Ukraine and China policy, the Arab countries are more ready to be independent, and that means readmitting Syria to the Arab League and, for most of them, normalizing relations.
So, Mr. Maruf, in your opinion, well, Saudi Arabia, we do know that it had long resisted normalization of ties with Damascus. Why this change of heart at this point in time?
As our guest mentioned just a minute ago, the international scene changing, the end of American hegemony and the rise of multipolarity. And we have to actually credit Syria for this rise of the new world of multipolar reality. Without the wall of Damascus, without the government of Syria, the military of Syria, the structures of Syria withstanding this 11 years of war and this international coalition that the United States led invading the country, Russia wouldn't be in a position today to actually defend itself, for instance, in Ukraine. Imagine if those Wahhabi death squads that the United States on Syria, if they survived, where they would be today and how they would be moved as we see the Nazi militias being moved to the Ukraine. So Syria was actually the beginning of this multipolar world. It's the time when Russia took a position to finally intervene militarily in a location where the United States was invading with its proxies. So this is where we're at, and the world is changing. The Arab countries that may have been vessels of the United States for a good of 80 somewhat years since the end of World War I, World War II, are now finding themselves in a position where the United States cannot protect them, and their economic future is tied to Asia and Africa, not to Europe and North America. And that's why we see the shift. And of course, that increases the possibility that these former vessel states like the Saudi Arabia or the United Arab Emirates or others that are normalizing with Syria right now will have a colored revolution plotted against it by the United States any minute now.
So, Mr. Ford, Mr. Maruf did point out that there is a new world order that is emerging. Do you believe that the United States is losing its grip on the Eastern Hemisphere with its plots have failed regarding Syria?
Absolutely. They're losing its grip. As the previous speaker just said, the United States' push for global power more or less came to an end in about 2014, by which time it was beginning to fail in Syria. Syria had withstood the incoming tide from the U.S.-supported Arab Spring, and the tide had come to its highest point. And the same could be said about Ukraine. 2014 was an important year there also. And so everything we've seen in the last 9 years has been a weakening of the U.S. Stranglehold over the Middle East. There have been other important milestones as well, like the tanker war in the Gulf in about 2018. Which saw, among other things, an attack on a Saudi refinery. This proved that America could not defend its allies, and those allies, like Saudi Arabia, have now become realistic, are making peace with their old enemies, like Iran, and have realized that the best way to have security is not to have enemies.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
So, Mr. Maruf, Saudi Arabian Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan visited Damascus last month for the first time in more than a decade. The two countries have decided to reopen their embassies and restore flights between the two countries. What is the significance of this escalation in bilateral ties, this rapprochement, if you will?
Well, basically, Saudi Arabia currently is the biggest financier and of most of the Arab states, let's say. And that's why we see the Arab League right now jumping very fast into returning Syria into the organization because Saudi Arabia said so. And it means also the same thing for the Gulf states and the Gulf Cooperation Council. What Saudi Arabia says to these countries happens. So what does this mean? This means that right now we will see an acceleration of this normalization between all the Arab states and Syria, the former states that stayed out of Syria since 2011. And partially, we will see some of those states paying a price for it, as we see Egypt already paying a price for that reality with the war in Sudan being instigated by the United States and Israel to weaken it in this state. So we will see an increase of probable problems in those countries that are now normalizing with Syria by the United States pressure. And as you know, the reality is that Syria will be the winner of this no matter what. And it shows that resistance to American invasions is the right way to go. And it's worse to be a friend of the United States than to be an enemy.
Interesting. So Mr. Ford, Jordan, Kuwait and Qatar oppose Bashar al-Assad's presence in the Arab League. What are the reasons behind that, and how do you foresee the future for these three countries?
Well, each one of those is different. Jordan is weak, less able to withstand U.S. Pressure. Qatar has its particular problems with Saudi Arabia and never wants to follow a Saudi lead. That there is a struggle between the petrol superpower Saudi Arabia and the gas superpower Qatar, and at the moment the Saudis are winning. Kuwait has always been a maverick, but thankfully does not have huge significance today. What matters now is Saudi leadership. We will, in a matter of days, by May 19, the Arab summit, we will see Assad, no doubt, being welcomed at the Arab League summit in Riyadh. This will be a bitter blow for the United States. And it's also very important for what happens now inside Syria. The opposition, what's left of it, will be even more demoralized. The momentum now is all with the Syrian government. No doubt after the Turkish elections, the Turks will withdraw their troops from Syria. And all that remains then is for the armed opposition groups to negotiate terms of surrender. And this will leave the United States isolated as the remaining holdout.
So, Mr. Maruf, we discussed a new world order emerging, and of course, Mr. Ford also shed more light on the role that the United States used to play in the region and how that role has diminished. Now let's put Iran in the mix. Let's not forget that all of this is happening while Saudi Arabia and Iran have also reestablished their diplomatic ties and they're growing closer. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi visited Damascus just a few days ago, and that was, of course, a historic visit after nearly 12 years, a very important visit with lots of agreements being signed, bilateral relations expanding, particularly in trade and business. Tell us what role does Iran play in this entire equation?
Well, of course, that visit was historic, and it solidified the alliance between Syria and Turkey that has been unshakable since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. And it was also a signal to the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia, who may think that opening up the Arab League and some rebuilding and connections with Syria may sway Syria away from its brotherly relationship with Iran, that this will never happen. Of course, we must remember that Syria in multiple times over the last 20 somewhat years since the invasion of Iraq has been pressured and by the United States and offered much wealth and much trade if it gives up both the resistance in Lebanon and its relationship with Iran, and that never happened even under the pressures of the war that lasted 10 years on Syria. So this is a very important also significance for Iran to show, this relationship, how for anybody else around the region, to show how this brotherly relationship is extendable to anybody, that we don't need foreign imperial forces in the region to safeguard everybody's security, and that only relationships that are brotherly between the nations of the region will guarantee that security. This is the significance of that visit.
That's an interesting point you raise there. So, Mr. Ford, it seems that the divide and rule policy that the West particularly has been trying to implement in the Eastern Hemisphere is now failing. Can you shed more light on that and, of course, Iran's role in this entire normalization of ties that we see?
Well, what's happened has been a victory for steadfastness. The Arabs call it sumud, steadfastness. And there's a steadfastness front, which includes Syria and Iran and Hezbollah and some of the Palestinian groups. And they have shown patience over the last 12 years, patience which is now being rewarded at great speed. The momentum now is all with the resistance front, the steadfastness front, and the absolute pivot for this has been Iran. Without Iran, Syria would have fallen by 2014 or earlier. This on the part of the United States, Syria was always the war against Syria by America was always just a prelude to and part of the war against Iran. It was a way primarily to weaken Iran, ready for changing the government of Iran. Well, it's all come to nothing. It's now crumbling in a really embarrassing way. And this is why the United States is so angry tonight.
Thank you very much, Peter Ford, former British ambassador to Syria, joining us live from Manchester, and Leith Maarouf, activist and political commentator from Beirut. That's all the time that we have for this edition of The Spotlight, and I'm very grateful that you shared your thoughts and views with us in this edition.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah هو إذا الرحمن
Allah
هو إذا المنان.
لا إله إلا. Please send us your emails to our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I am Atta, the host of this program. Brother Suhail is here to answer our questions. Assalamu alaikum, brother. Welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum salam. Thank you, dear viewers. Thank you, brother.
Okay, brother Suhail, let's talk about an important topic for today's discussion. And that is the time of death. Some Shias believe that at the time of this, they would see the face of Imam Ali alayhi salam. This is the first part of our today's question. And the other one is that, is it true that the Shias, for example, would not go to hellfire because of the Hadith, because of the love that they have for the Ahlul Bayt? Let's first talk about the first segment, seeing the face of Imam Ali at the time of death. Is it true?
So we have tradition from the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, where he says, O Ali, your friends will triumph in three places, when their souls are separated from their body and you would be present beside them. Two would be, you would guide them when they are being questioned in the grave. And three, you would introduce them when they are presented before Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We have a narration from Al-Harith Al-Hamadani that says, when I went to Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salam, he asked me, what brought you here? I replied, the love for you, O Amir al-Mu'mineen. And he asked, do you adore me, O Harith? And he replied, indeed, by God I do. He said, even as your soul reaches your throat, at the moment of your death, you would see me as a friend you loved. You would find me to be the friend you loved, even as I would be scattering people like driving away wild camels which do not belong to my herd. You would find me a friend that you loved when you see me crossing the bridge with the Prophet, peace be upon him, holding aloft the banner of unicity in my hand. Then Hazrat Ali, Imam Ali alayhi salam says, O Harith Hamnan, whoever dies sees me, whether he be a believer or a hypocrite. You see? So we have traditions that actually say that we would see Amir al-Mu'mineen at the time of our death. Now, here we can take it literally that we will see him and understand and know that it is him. And so we will know that Amir al-Mu'mineen is there at the time of our death. So we have this narration as well that says that Imam Ali says, anyone who loves us when they pass away, and they are happy, like they would be in happy state, and they would see us, they would visit, they would view us, they would be able to see us, those states, yeah.
That's right. So this is for the first segment of the question.
Yeah, this is for the first segment of the question. Then we have the second segment about the Shias won't go to hell.
Is it true that the Shias will not go to hell, for example, because the love they have for Ahlul Bayt or something?
So here we have some traditions that say about the Shias and their connection with Amirul Mu'minin. And here we need to first identify who the Shias are, whether literal meaning, technical meaning, or according to Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. So here Shia literally means they include party, ummah, faction, companion, follower, friend, helper, and a group of people who have converged and gathered on a matter. So whenever you see a group of people, you could literally call them Shias. The technical meaning, however, Shia in its technical meaning refers to those who believe in the immediate successorship to Imam Ali alayhi salam, and also believe that such succession has been alluded to him through explicit and implicit mention, and that it is his and his progeny's right.
Yes.
Conceptually, the term Shia has been used for different meanings. At times, it has been used to refer political support or advocacy or friendship. At other times, it has also been used to mean following the infallible imams in practice. Now here we have the meaning of Shia according to infallible imams, of which we have certain narrations that say what is understood from these narrations of the imams is that a Shia doesn't simply mean affiliated with the denomination out of all other denominations. Rather, being a follower, a Shia of Ahlul Bayt entails chastity and struggles in the way of Allah, such that a person will be a true Shia. For that reason, on different occasions did the Imam deal seriously with those people who regarded themselves as Shia to justify their needs. Then there are some narrations that are said. So here, if it depends on the second question, that when you say love Ahlul Bayt, what do you mean? It's just, okay, I love Ahlul Bayt, but then I don't follow him. Do you mean that kind of a Shia? Or no, you actually mean a Shia who actually follows the Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
So if you say the one who actually follows in this literal meaning of the one given by the infallible imams, yes, they won't touch her.
Mm-hmm.
You see? But if you are saying about just being a Shia, no. So we have the verses in the Quran where the foundations of someone to go to hell and heaven is his actions. You see? And it's not like someone would just get a free pass just because he's a Shia or something. But at the same time, we have seen these narrations that one of the imams has stated, if I'm not mistaken, that I do not fear for my Shias the day of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
For there is tawassul in place as well, that takes place in the day of judgment.
You mean the real Shias, of course, the followers.
So we hear in the narration that we have that it's not only those Shias, even those who might have been doing sins and mistakes that have asked for repentance and stuff, wherever, and that's why we have a tradition as well that Al-Mahdi alayhi salam says that whenever they come to me on the day of judgment, like on the day of accountability, he will have the right to ask Allah for forgiveness of these few Shias, these Shias, and therefore he says, don't come with an account that has sins and things that I cannot ask wasila for and be your guide over there. You see? So we have that as well. But generally speaking, what we see is regarding to after death,